So hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for rural grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. The title for our call today is An Elusive Crime, Stalking in Rural Communities. I am joined on the line by my esteemed colleague from the Stalking Resource Center, Jody Rafkin, who will be the facilitator for today's discussion. Our training goals today will be to consider the best practices and model programs for assisting stalking victims, to consider threat assessment and the benefits of a coordinated community response to stalking. And so, Jody, we are thrilled that you were able to be on the line with us today. Welcome.
Thank you. I am delighted to have been asked by Praxis to do this presentation today, especially since it is National Stalking Awareness Month. My background is that I was a prosecutor for approximately 20 years in state court in Los Angeles and then as a federal prosecutor in Sacramento. I started doing domestic violence work in the mid-1980s, working with multi-ethnic victims of domestic violence at a time when DA's offices were shifting to a we will prosecute regardless of what the victim wants phase. And I was the National Violence Against Women Act coordinator when the Federal Violence Against Women Act was passed in the 1990s, and was fortunate enough to do a lot of work with the FBI and law enforcement and local DA's offices and victim advocates to make them aware of the new federal laws and the new tools that were available to combat domestic violence. And I was also so pleased to see a bipartisan Congress finally recognize that interpersonal and domestic violence is a national issue. It's a national problem we should all be looking at, not something that should stay behind closed doors. And so I was really pleased to come to the Stalking Resource Center 18 months ago and to start really focusing on working with advocates, law enforcement, prosecutors, community corrections officers, all of the people who are such vital parts of making a difference in the lives of stalking victims. And so what we're going to talk about today is how to work best with stalking victims. One of the things that is challenging for someone like me in doing an event like this, and it was fabulous to hear all of you from all your different places all over the country, is my sense is that there are some of you who have had a fair amount of training or been to Stalking Resource Center or Praxis or BJWP or National Network 10 Domestic Violence training on stalking, and some of you who have not had as much of that training. So the first section in our presentation, I'm going to move through a little more quickly because it's some background information on stalking, and I don't want to have the people who've already had stalking training feel like, oh, this is something I've already heard again, but I don't want people who haven't had it before to feel like they're playing catch-up. So part of it is for the people who haven't been exposed to this before to have the written materials to refer to later and to feel free to follow up with emails if there are further questions, and just to refresh everybody and get us all on the same page as we move forward to talking about how to work with our stalking victims. There are stalking laws in all 50 states. There are federal stalking laws. Stalking is recognized in the Uniform Code of Military Justice as an offense, and a number of our tribal codes now include stalking violations. To work with a general theory of what stalking is, people really should be familiar with their own state's stalking laws, so you know, and when you're working with victims, you can help them understand what your law enforcement officers and your prosecutors will need if you're going down the criminal justice route. So if you're interested in looking at your own statute, our website has all of the current stalking laws. One of the things, because we're talking about what makes a reasonable person feel fearful, think about the fact that that is different for each of us. And we need to think about context in stalking cases, because the backstory is often very, very important into why a victim feels fearful. A lot of times when people think about stalking, they think about celebrities. They think it happens to people like Uma Thurman, David Letterman, Steven Spielberg. They don't think that it happens to regular people. And also sometimes people in more rural communities think that only happens in the big city. There was a study released a year ago this month by the Department of Justice Bureau of Justice Statistics that was the first national study done in 10 years. And what that study showed us was that 3.4 million people are stalked annually. So it's not just celebrities, it's people just like you and me and our friends and families. And you have some statistics in the PowerPoint that show that women are more likely to be stalked than men, that people in our colleges and universities have a higher level of stalking than the general population, and more statistics about the level and how often our victims get contacted. Also, one of the ones that I really like to get people thinking about is 11% of stalking goes on for 5 years or more. So everything you know about stalking, when you're working with your victims, think about what it would feel like to have these kinds of stressors, pressures, threats, and harassment in your life or the life of someone you loved and cared about for 5 years or more. Going through our gender of our victims and our offenders, our women are more often stalked by men. Men are equally distributed because we often get the old boyfriend, the stalker, stalking the new boyfriend, the new love interest of the victim. One of the largest relationship groups that we have between our victims and offenders are current or former intimate partners. So we always like to point out and have people think about the relationship between stalking and intimate partner violence. And the studies really support the fact that many, many women who are the victims of domestic violence are also stalking victims as well. And some of the behaviors that we have always realized were part of the emotional abuse that's involved in intimate partner violence, we may not have always labeled as stalking. And stalking often occurs while relationships are ongoing. And things like checking the victim's cell phone to see who she or he has been calling, checking their emails, making sure that they're coming home from work, showing up at work to making sure that the victim is where they say they are. All of those things are stalking that we don't always recognize when the relationship is still ongoing and not after the breakup. We also have seen from advocates and victims, as well as confirmed and substantiated by the statistics, that there can be a connection between stalking and sexual assault, and that often stalking will be a lead up to a sexual assault. And an older study showed that almost a third of women who were stalked by their intimate partner were also sexually assaulted by that partner. And the newer study has a smaller number, but the newer study did not break the groups out by their relationship. So just think about that if you are talking with a sexual assault victim and they start giving you information in terms of knowing that someone had been following them or a sense that someone was watching them before the attack occurred, that there may have been stalking behavior related to that sexual assault. The kinds of behaviors we're talking about can be very varied, and our stalkers can be very creative and manipulative. The common and long-standing is the following and surveillance, sending gifts, vandalism. We talk with law enforcement all the time about how vandalism is very often tied to and an indication of an escalation of violence in stalking behavior. Stealing items from the victim. When there's a protective order, if there are violations, very often that correlates with stalking. Threats against the victim and other friends and families, targeting children if it is a former live-in relationship where there are children, getting to children, getting to family members, getting to the new boyfriend, coworkers, friends. Proxy stalking, having friends, family members assist with the stalking, especially if there's an order of protection or someone has already been convicted of a crime and is under some kind of supervision. We talked about the physical and sexual assault piece. Workplace stalking. I'm sure all of you can think of either a local headline or a national headline where someone went into a workplace and harmed a victim and their coworkers. Using the legal system to harass, and also using children, and technology can come into play in this part to help monitor the victim. And technology, I'm not here to bash technology. And technology has done some wonderful things, and technology has not created stalking. Stalking has probably been going on since time began, and it's been illegal since the 1990s, but what technology does is it changes the way a stalker can stalk. And I encourage all of you that when victims come in and start talking about, I feel like he's always showing up places, and I don't know how he knows. I feel like I'm being watched. How does he or she know this information when I don't know how they got it? Don't just dismiss the victim as being paranoid. Don't think that they are imagining things that aren't happening, because there are so many ways for stalkers to use technology and to find out about what victims are doing without them being aware of it. And the most recent study has shown us that more than 1 in 4 victims report some form of technology being used in the stalking. When we're talking about the patterns of behavior, how often our stalking occurs, 2/3 of our stalkers pursue the victims at least once a week. And the study that this slide refers to, the RECON study, was done by Dr. Chris Mohandy. And a lot of our other studies go from information provided by victims. This study looked at over 1,000 police reports from defendants who were arrested and prosecuted for stalking in about 4 different jurisdictions in California. So it's nice to see that piece from the other side. So we've got 2/3 of our stalkers pursuing at least once a week, and 78% using more than one means of approach, which means our victims never know what area they're going to be assaulted from next. It's not just the phone calls, not just the driving by, the text messages, the emails. It's coming from every angle, which increases their level of apprehension, anxiety, and fear, and why no place starts to feel safe to them, which is a real impediment often for them really being able to come and feel that they can trust you. The statistics support the recent ones from last year about unwanted phone calls, rumors, spying, the statistics supporting all of the information that we're hearing from advocates and victims about the behaviors. One of the things that is most challenging for all of us in dealing with stalking is there's really high recidivism rates. 60% of our cases, our stalkers do not stop because of intervention by the criminal justice system, which means that's a lot of work for victim safety and why our community corrections officers and probation and parole are such important partners for us to work with. We also hear from all over the country that the stalking continues from inside county jails and inside state prisons. Our reporting statistics for stalking are not quite as low as domestic violence or sexual assault, but we've still got an average of about 40% of our stalking victims reporting. And it's the kinds of things that I'm sure don't surprise any of you. Because of the nature of stalking, because it is so often made up of incidents that aren't in and of themselves crimes, unless they're part of stalking conduct, the phone calls, the driving by, the surveillance, our victims are really good at minimizing. They say, oh, well, he didn't really commit a crime. If I just ignore him, he'll go away. It isn't that big a deal, and I'm going to make less of it. So minimization is a big reason our victims don't report. They also feel that it's personal or private. They tell other people. They're not clear that a crime is occurring, which is why it's so important and why I so appreciate all of you making time to really understand stalking so that you can educate them, and why National Stalking Awareness Month is so important to let our communities know what stalking is, and so our victims will be clear that this is not acceptable behavior, and to help them recognize it and seek you out and seek law enforcement out to deal with the issues. They didn't think the police would think it important. They couldn't identify or lacked evidence. And that's another important piece, and we're going to talk about more later during this call, is if you think about it, stalking is the only crime where we often are relying on our victims to collect the evidence for us. Because even if you've got the best law enforcement officer, the best advocate who really want to support that victim, if the victim is getting 200 threatening text messages a day, 40 or 50 or 60 threatening phone messages a day, you can't be there all the time to help the victim record those. So working with the victim to help them understand how to document is a huge piece. And remembering that fear is a part of the stalking behavior some of our victims really feel that they are too fearful to report because they feel that the conduct will accelerate and become more life-threatening to them. Looking at the impact on our victims, which I'm sure all of you see in all of the fabulous work that you do with the victims, is again the minimization and self-blame, the guilt and embarrassment, frustration, shock, confusion. Nothing feels safe anymore. There's fear and anxiety, depression, numbness, the flashbacks, feeling disconnected and isolating yourself from family and friends because you're fearful of the stalker harming them as well. The suicidal feelings, the effect on work, as well as post-traumatic stress, sleep disturbances, dysfunction and fatigue, weight, self-medicating with alcohol and drugs, and the hypervigilance. All of the things that our victims report to us, and it's supported by the research in terms of the emotional impact, the financial impact, the mental impact. And in these tough economic times, how hard would it be for any of our victims, especially if they've got kids and are supporting families, to find another job right now if they lost their job because of the effect that the stalking was having on them? And the most recent study showed us that almost half of our victims are afraid of not knowing what would happen next. And think about that in your own life. Think about the fact that, at least for me and many other people that I've talked with, it's what we don't know. It's the unknown that is so fearful for us. And for victims, that plays out in really large ways when the stalking is going on. And almost a third of them thought it would never stop, and almost 1 in 10 believed that their stalker was going to kill them. So, I know I moved through that pretty fast, but I don't want to bore the people who know it already. Are there any questions before we move into safety planning and threat assessment that anybody has about the basics of stalking and its prevalence and its impact and its lethality?
If you have a question or a comment right now, you can press 1 on your keypad, the number 1 once, and you will be entered into the operator queue and your line will be unmuted individually. Are there any questions at this time?
At this time, there are no questions in the queue.
Jody, you did a fantastic job. I can't believe you got through all of those slides so quickly.
Well, it's that balancing. I know that some of our people are really well trained in this already, so I know that I don't want people to tune out, but I didn't want anybody to feel that they didn't have a good foundation as we moved forward. So I'm glad the timing of that worked for everyone. Thank you.
Yeah, I think it was great. And let me ask just one more time before Stephanie proceeds into the advocacy response. Are there any questions or comments at this time? If so, press 1 on your telephone, and your line will be unmuted.
Okay, Community Works, your line is open.
If a victim does report a stalking crime, does that increase the likelihood of them being targets of violence from their abuser?
It certainly can, it's a great question, and we're going to talk about it more as we go through our threat assessment and safety planning. But very often, when a victim reports, when they go to an advocate to report, but especially when they go to law enforcement, and if an offender is arrested, that really ratchets up and is a red flag for needing to do safety planning with your victim and to talk about the increased risk. And we always like law enforcement and prosecutors to be aware of that as well. But absolutely, for those of you working with victims, you should be talking through with them the fact that there is a good possibility that when a victim comes forward, there will be heightened risk to them, and what steps can you take with them to try and make them safer.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for your question. Are there any other questions or comments at this time?
Yes. KS Coalition Against Sexual and Violence Prevention Council, your line is open.
I just wonder if you can touch on how stalking might look a little different in rural areas.
In rural areas, what I think makes it more of a challenge is everybody tends to know everybody. It's a smaller community. which means people may tend to minimize it more and try and make less of it, that our victims potentially will be even more reluctant to come forward for the fear of the shame or embarrassment or worrying what the community is going to think. And is it going to play out in terms of breaking a community apart? Are people going to start taking sides? Also, though, one of the things that can be helpful is if a victim does come forward, more people may be able to think, well, oh, yeah, I saw Joe going down by her street. So with a sense, more of a sense of community awareness within the rural areas, there may be more tools and support for a victim if she gets support from her friends in helping to see the conduct that the stalker is engaging in. Are you seeing specific things in stalking cases in your rural community?
I think a lack of resources sometimes for survivors of stalking in terms of, you know, they both go to the same church, they both shop at the same store, those kinds of things that I think really impact survivors in a different way in rural areas.
Absolutely.
You know, only one school, only one high school, that kind of stuff.
You bring up a fabulous and really important point. In larger areas, it is so much easier for victims to change their patterns if they want, to safety plan around changing routes, going different places. And you really beautifully pointed out that in the rural communities, those often aren't choices. If you've only got one market, if there is, say, one school, if there are very limited things, then it's going to be much harder for a victim to get away from the stalker. Absolutely.
Well, I think the other piece, too, is that the system seemed to not be willing to divide these things up. So, for example, you may have a judge or a law enforcement officer or an attorney who says you can still go to church even if she's there. So they're not really willing to divide these resources up in the community in order to protect survivors either.
I agree with you, and that is one of our biggest challenges in terms of reaching out to judges and trying to get them to understand, because we hear horror stories, and I'm sure you guys have too, from all over the country before we even get to stalking, when we're also talking about intimate partner violence, where a judge will say, oh, I just want you to go to church and get counseling and keep the marriage together. And you get the bench minimizing the stalking behavior and going, well, oh, you know, it's not that big a deal. You can just, you know, just don't talk to her, but both of you go to church. And so we have to try and educate them. And that's one of our bigger challenges. And we're still a long way from getting them to get the importance of that piece and really supporting the victims.
And Jody, will that particular issue about kind of the system's response, is part of that going to be taken up in the CCR pieces that you cover towards the latter portion of this training today?
Yes. Judges are often not part of our CCRs. And one of the great things for all of us to try and think about is we often get told by judges that they feel that if we gave them training and information on stalking, that they would appear biased and partial toward victims. And we try so hard to say, we're not asking you to rule in favor of the victim every time. We are simply saying that being educated and having knowledge is important. And having knowledge does not mean that you're biased. So thinking about ways, and we'll talk about it more in the community coordinated response piece, of is there a way to, especially in rural communities, where judges tend to be more visible, more personable, to have more personal relationships with people than in some larger cities, is there a way to get them involved and to try and get them to feel they're not going to be biased, they're just going to have better information, and how can we include them? Because they are such an important piece.
And Jody, are there any rural-specific resources that you can think of, whether at the Stalking Resource Center or the National Center for Victims of Crime, or anything that would have a little more of a rural focus? focus to it?
Well, you guys at Praxis are sort of in the forefront of the rural, so it's the work that we do with you. When we go out to rural jurisdictions, we always make sure that we talk to the issues that exist in rural communities. We hear so often from our rural law enforcement officers, you sometimes have four officers on a shift to cover an area the size of the state of Connecticut. And so those issues within law enforcement, within rural law enforcement, not having the manpower, the distances they have to get, the problems with the timeliness of responses. So I don't know of a specific publication that addresses the rural issues. It's more the wonderful calls like this and the discussions that we get into when we go out to do training in rural areas.
Right. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Stephanie, are there any callers in the queue at this time?
Not at this time.
All right. Very good. So, Jody, I would just direct you back to your PowerPoint, if you would, and I'd like to just let the rest of you know that, again, Jody will be stopping for questions within the next half an hour. And so certainly jot down your question if you have something that occurs to you in the next 30 minutes or so, and we'll be happy to take your questions and comments at that time.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you, Jody.
So, the meat and potatoes, safety planning and threat assessment. I'm sure you all probably know more about hands-on safety planning in many ways than I do, but how do we define it? What really is safety planning, and do we look at it differently? And so that's why I want to sort of start at the foundation and talk about what is safety planning. And we all probably may do it a little bit differently. But we like to say it's an individualized plan that identifies specific strategies and interventions that may increase a survivor's safety. And you all know this, no two victims are alike. And we can't do a sort of cookie cutter, which often our justice system gets accused of, oh, okay, you did this, this is the response, and this is what's supposed to work for everybody. Because our victims are so different, because the person who's stalking them is different, it's going to be an individualized look at what we can do to try and increase our victim's safety. The strategies are going to be responding to the stalking, meeting basic human needs, and also taking into account the victim's broader life plan. And why do we safety plan? One of the big things is to help empower victims. Because of all of the things we talked about in the first segment, so much of what our victims endure is a loss of power and control. And we all know how tied to power and control intimate partner violence is. So our victims who are being bombarded from all these different angles are feeling very often so completely powerless. So doing even small steps with an advocate to take back some control and get some more safety in their life can be really empowering to a victim. And it provides practical, not just theoretical, but actual, yes, we can go out and do this, practical ways to decrease risk. It puts victims in contact with a lot of services, which in our rural communities especially too may be hard for them because they're afraid to ask or it's just a challenge for them to get the resources that they need. Always, it's important to never guarantee safety to a victim because there are just too many things that are beyond our control. So framing the conversation not in a, oh, we can absolutely make you safe, but framing it in ways of this is the way we can work together to improve your safety. We have to keep it fluid. We have to keep looking at it because our stalkers and abusers are continually changing their tactics. So we will need to safety plan and work with our victim and assess the risk in a constant changing mode to respond to what the stalker is doing. And we also safety plan because we know it works. Because we are the National Center for Victims of Crime, and I'm sure so many of you, depending on what the mission of your organization is, we really focus on survivor-centered safety planning and advocacy. And we want to start from a perspective of the survivor's perspective, integrating the advocate's knowledge and resources and valuing the survivor's thoughts. And this has really been a journey for me, because when I was a prosecutor in the mid-1980s in Los Angeles, taking the stands of victim, I know better than you do how to keep you safe. I'm going forward with this case. You know, whether you don't want to or not, that's not my marching orders, and I'm going forward. And that really devalues our victims' input, and it really minimizes and I think is harmful to them to be treated as though their feelings, their opinions, or their dreams are secondary to what the system wants. So we really want to be advocates that are involving our victims and making them be the decision makers. It is so good and valuable for their lives, for their self-esteem, for them going forward, not to be simply doing what we tell them to do, but to feel that they are a part of the process, that they are the decision makers, that they are the one who has the power in the situation to help change and make things better. We like to talk about safety planning with four different components: the safety aspect, documentation, advocacy, and support. And simply asking the victim, are you safe? And some people go, well, you know, that's a silly question. You know, they don't know whether they're safe or not. And it may not be the final end-all be-all, and I'm not saying that what your victim tells you may forms and is the only thing you look at in your determination of whether or not you think the victim is safe. But asking that question to a victim will give you some really interesting insight into where the victim is, what the victim's thinking, and what their safety concerns are, trying to get them to really verbalize what is it that feels safe to them, what is it in their life that doesn't feel safe to them. So it's a really good opening question. Another really important thing to think about when you're talking about safety and developing your relationship with the victim is making sure that on the front end you define your role and you talk to them about your privacy and confidentiality limitations. If we have any system-based advocates on the line who work in prosecutors' offices or police departments, this can be a real challenge to you. Community-based advocates are in a clearer space where they are not part of an organization that has a different agenda or role or goal like a police department or a prosecutor's office. Very often what we hear from our advocates who are in police departments and prosecutors' offices is they have obligations from their department that what they are told by a victim needs to go into a report, needs to go to an officer. So depending on the kind of advocacy work that you do, you really need to make clear with your victim up front what is and isn't going to be confidential. If you're a mandatory reporter, if there's child abuse involved, what you're going to have to tell somebody else about, so that once you start to build this really important relationship with a victim, you are not somewhere down the road with a situation where your victim feels you've betrayed their trust because you couldn't keep something confidential that they told you. Important issues for all of us to consider are looking at the victim's life situation. What's really going on in their life that affects their ability to stay safe? What are the stalker-generated risks? What can they share with you? Because our victims know the stalker's triggers, know the stalker's pattern, know what escalates stalking behavior better than any of the rest of us. So having the victim share what the risks are that their stalker is generating. What are the systemic barriers? And we were talking about that in some of the earlier questions. You know, talking with your victim about how the system impacts them in your community that keeps them from getting the services they need. Again, the confidentiality and the use of technology. And this is going to be informed by each of our comfort level with technology, by our victim's comfort level with technology, and also our offender's level. The one thing I would like you to try and remember is the way things are these days, you don't have to have a lot of money, and you don't have to be really tech-savvy or a real techie or a real gamer online guy to be able to use technology to stalk. If you were to go to a search engine like Google and put in the phrase stalk wife, stalk girlfriend, stalk boyfriend, the last time we checked, you would get over 3 million hits. There's a lot of information out there for people who want to use technology to stalk. And you can buy things like GPS tracking devices to put on a car for as little as $85. And there's really clear instructions about how to use them. So be aware that even if you're in a rural community, this is something that your stalkers could be using. When we look at safety, so often everybody's first instinct is to disengage and have no contact. You know, we tell the victim, if the stalker calls you 60 times and gets no answer, but finally on the 61st time you pick up the phone, what our stalker takes away is, okay, so I need to call her 61 times to get her to answer. So in many ways, sending the clear signal of I don't want contact with you and disconnecting is often everybody's first choice. But realize that there may be things in the victim's life and things that the victim feels she needs to do to stay safe that will cause her to have contact with the stalker. And we should accept that without judgment. We should listen to and be open to the reasons why. There was a judge who was outraged when he heard that a victim called her stalker on the phone every single morning. And he was like, well, why should I renew a protection order? Why should I think that she's fearful if she calls him every morning? And then the victim explained that she called him at home every morning because if he answered the phone at home, she knew that he was at home and that she had time to safely get to work. And if he didn't answer his phone, she didn't know where he was out there. And she was afraid that he was on her front porch, he was parked in front of her house, or he was somewhere where he was going to harm her. So when you get that backstory in the context, then that contact makes a little more sense. And also, especially when we're looking at situations where there are children are involved, if a stalking victim feels that meeting a stalker for lunch or even potentially having sex with a stalker is going to prevent physical harm or prevent harm to the children, a stalking victim is going to do that, no matter how frustrating that may seem to a judge or a detective or anyone working with the victim. So we have to realize that that's a challenging area that we need to talk with our victims about, but be open to the fact that complete disengagement may not feel like an option to them. Threat assessment is an important piece of safety planning. No contact letters are something that are used in different departments. Some areas find that they have a lot of success with them. And in fact, some of your state laws may have language that says if a stalker is notified that a victim wants no further contact, that is prima facie evidence that any further contact is stalking. But some departments feel that it's like saying, we don't think it's that big a deal. You wouldn't tell an auto burglar, okay, you've broken into 3 or 4 cars. Here's a letter telling you that if you do it again, we're going to arrest you. But it's something for you to talk about in your community and think about whether or not that's a resource that you'd like to use. Talking with victims about showing people pictures or flyers of the offender. And sometimes that's hard because victims don't want to have to share that piece with everyone, but especially if a stalker is coming to the workplace, if it's a situation where there's a concern about the stalker picking up a child at school. Also, we hear stories around the country where stalkers will pose as a private investigator or go to an auto place like Jiffy Lube and ask for information about the victim. And a lot of these people who aren't in our field don't know about the kinds of risks that we do. They don't know any better, and they provide our stalkers information about our victims. So it really can be very helpful, especially if a victim has moved to a new apartment building, to just show the new neighbors a picture of the stalker and say, you know, if you see this guy around here or if he starts asking about me, can you please let me know? It can be a very helpful piece of safety planning. So what are our steps of safety planning? Active listening is such a huge piece. You really want to listen actively to what the victim is saying and ask follow-up questions and really make sure that you and the victim are on the same page with all of the information. Identify your victim's specific needs and goals. What do they want? Do they want to go forward in the criminal justice system? Do they want a protection order? Do they want to relocate? What are the things that really are important to them, and what are their goals that they would like to see in their future? Talk about the risks. Explore all of the different strategies and resources. Do education without judgment. And identify another piece that we'll talk about more in the coordinated community response. Who else in your community, individuals and service providers, can help your victim? And realize that a lot of this is going to be asking questions and not always having the answer. And so now we're going to get to some of the harder things that come up in safety planning and some questions to consider. And I'd love you guys to think about this, and in four or five slides, when we get to questions, for us to discuss it further. You know, what safety strategies can survivors use that don't involve the legal system? What do you do if a stalking victim tells you about stalking, but they absolutely don't want to involve the police? What can you do when law enforcement doesn't know how to respond or the system's not responsive? What if your state law makes it really difficult to go forward? What if your law enforcement isn't trained yet and really isn't that responsive to victims, or your prosecutor's office or your judges aren't? How do you help your victim when the legal system isn't going to really provide the safety that we would like it to do? One of our biggest challenges, what do we do for the survivor if the stalker has access to or works in the system? If they're a law enforcement officer, a probation or parole officer, a judge, any of those situations make things so much harder. A local politician, anyone with power or within the system who could influence it, makes it so much harder for our victims to come forward. And also, what potential safety risks exist during evidence collection and legal system involvement, which goes back to our first good question about how the safety risks increase once a victim does come forward. And also, that a lot of times, and I'm sure many of you have experienced this already, that you are potentially trying to find ways to provide support when you don't have solutions and when there aren't potentially solutions. You know, I don't want to go to the police, but I want him in jail. How to help victims collect evidence and document when there aren't laws broken. You know, and the CSI effect. You know, I have to admit that I watch some of the CSI shows. I watch some of the Law and Order shows. You know, a lot of us do, especially our jury pools. But realize that real-life crimes aren't solved in 50 minutes or less. And I got to tell you, I worked for the feds for 12 years, and none of us ever had equipment like I've seen in these shows. So the perception on the behalf of our victim and on the behalf of our communities that we can all do things that we really can't. And also finding and doing support, where are there additional services needed? When is there something that is beyond what we can do locally, and how do we get those services? And that takes us to pulling on outside expertise and going to people like Praxis and the Stalking Resource Center and Battered Women's Justice Project and National Network to End Domestic Violence Safety Net, who do lots of great work around technology, looking at all of these national TA providers, and we're here because we want to help you find the answers to these questions. Bringing in law enforcement, getting them training, and realizing that there are lots of really wonderful law enforcement officers who get it and who want to help. The same thing for attorneys and prosecutors. Not only do we try to reach out, and we're starting to partner more with prosecutor training groups, but also the National Center has a National Crime Victim Bar Association, where we work with civil attorneys all over the country who get training and are more awake and aware and interested in working with victims in civil court to try and help them when they can, when the criminal justice system does not do everything for a victim that we would like. And that there are also other specialized services that may be available outside your community to help with your victim's issues. So what other factors do we need to discuss with our victim? How to balance freedom and safety, which is so hard because you do end up having to give up some of your freedom to try and stay safe. And especially if the victim has teenagers and how you balance that and their freedom as well. Also, talking about real life next steps in case something does happen. And if he does A, what would you do? Where would you go? How would you respond? Really looking at nuts and bolts ways for them to try and think ahead of time how they could keep themselves safe. Talking with the victim about how often you need to reassess their plan with them. And again, as I mentioned before, that we're talking about risk reduction, not about absolute safety, because that is outside of our controls. So, any questions or comments that people want to talk about now with some of these more challenging aspects of us safety planning with our victims?
If there are questions or comments, you can press 1 on your telephone keypad and your line will be unmuted. Stephanie, do we have any questions at this time?
We do. We have Pennington County Sheriff's Office. Your line is open.
I have more of a comment than a question, maybe a combination. You know, we potentially put these women in a very difficult position. On the one hand, we know we can't guarantee absolute safety, so if there's always a risk, there's a reduced risk. And on the other hand, we want them to come forward. And if they know that we can't protect them to the extent that they would like to be protected, yet we expect them to come forward, it puts them in a very difficult position. And one of the issues that arose earlier was prosecuting, even if the victim doesn't want to prosecute. In the victim's mind, the fear factor may be, well, if law enforcement does its job and the prosecution does its job, I don't have to put myself at risk if sometime down the line this person is released or there might be friends that might want to get even if I come out and want to prosecute. So if I say I don't want to prosecute, but I know he'll be prosecuted anyway, then in the mind of the victim, that might be a safety factor.
I agree completely, and you have raised one of our biggest issues, the sort of, you know, question that doesn't always have a solution and that's very, very hard. And I used to tell victims sometimes when we would be having conversations, you know, you can tell him and I will in fact tell him that I'm the one who's the bitch here, not you, that you didn't want to do this and that I'm forcing you. And it may, in some situations, as you point out, be a way to help that victim, but I do think you have to be careful in terms of not always overpowering their ability to have input into what happens. So again, it's a really fine line and one of those really hard gray areas, because I agree with everything you said, that it is one of these sort of catch-22s that we want our victims to come forward, yes, but yet they are getting greater risk often when they come forward. So that is, I think, when it becomes so important for victims to be working with advocates and law enforcement officers who are thinking about risk assessment and safety and working with the advocates as well, if they don't have enough time to really be as involved in that, to talk about specific ways to try and keep the victim safer at the different portions and points through the criminal justice process.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments at this time?
At this time, there are no additional questions in the queue.
All right, then. Let's move on to advocacy, which is such a huge piece that I think is so amazing and powerful and extraordinary in terms of the work that advocates do with victims. Because the advocacy piece allows victims to actually tell their story and to remember more details as they do the telling, to have someone who's working with them without patience and with patience and without judgment. It facilitates those memories from being traumatic to being day-to-day so that they aren't as painful, and helps the victim move through the criminal justice process if that's the way that you are going. It also validates the victim's experience and allows them to get the feedback that all of the variety of emotions they're feeling aren't wrong or crazy or inappropriate, and that their reactions to these traumatic events are normal. And it validates all of this range from fear and guilt and frustration and grief, and lets them know from someone that they're building this wonderful, supportive, trusting relationship with that none of this is their fault, and that these are really common and appropriate reactions for them to be having. We also talked about our victims feeling powerless, so another huge piece of the advocacy part is prediction and preparation. Our victims need information. They need practical information about what their choices can be. They need practical information about this is what will happen if you go to the police, this is how a case will proceed, this is what will happen if the prosecutor charges it, this is what will happen if you get a protection order. And so it's practical information that allows them to make good decisions and gives them back some of the power, helps them regain control. It also gives them a chance to work through and talk through with the advocate what their emotional responses are potentially going to be to all of these different things along the journey that they are potentially choosing to go on. The documentation piece, as I mentioned, can be one of the hardest because we are relying on our victim to collect our evidence. We have a slide here with a sample of a stalking incident log. It is free and downloadable on our website, or if there's one that you use locally, we really encourage you to work with victims and help them to learn how to document the evidence. We also hear from a number of different departments and advocacy groups that they make stalking sacks for their stalking victims. They will often give them a cell phone, a different one than during the relationship, and a lot of companies like Verizon and other phone providers are very much wanting to be supportive of domestic violence victims, and they will provide donated phones. Often, though, work with your detectives because you will potentially want to keep collecting any threatening messages on the victim's phone, but give them a new one so that they don't have to listen to the threatening messages. Giving victims personal alarms or whistles or pepper spray or mace, we really encourage advocates to make sure that victims are trained on pepper spray and mace if they're being given them. Cameras to take pictures of things that may be changing or if the offender is outside their home, or pictures of threatening text messages that are left. We talked about the log. We've had some advocates suggest that they have had really good luck providing their victims with watches with a date, because if you are relying on your victim to collect your evidence, I know from all the training and traveling that I do around the country, sometimes I have trouble remembering what day it is. And with the stress and strain that our victims are under, if they are making a log and that potentially is something that they may be cross-examined on later by a defense attorney, it would be really good to help them make sure that they are being accurate with the date. Also, check with your state laws. In some states, it is legal to record a conversation as long as one party to the conversation consents. In some states, that's illegal, and your victim could actually be prosecuted if they recorded a conversation with the stalker. But if it is legal in your state for your victim to do that, you may want to think about getting them a tape recorder so that if the stalker calls and is threatening them or harassing them or shows up and has a face-to-face threatening conversation with them, they can have a tape-recorded record of that. There was also a group in Sacramento that came up with victim and offender folders. And these folders started off with a pre-printed letter to law enforcement telling law enforcement that the folder contains descriptive information about the victim and a possible offender related to a current call, and that the victim compiled this because of ongoing domestic violence or stalking behavior. And then if you look at it, it's got all of this incredible information about the victim, and then all of the same information, including social security number, height and weight, driver's license, all of this information about the offender. photographs, vehicle information, but being aware that sometimes our offenders are savvy enough to use rental cars because they know we may be looking for their regular car, but still vehicle information, friend and family addresses, a description of the behavior, the numbers and information about any prior police reports that have been made, and protective orders. And think about this from a law enforcement perspective. If you were handed this when a victim had gone missing, how much easier that makes it for law enforcement. And we've heard at least from one situation I know of where a stalking victim was so concerned for her safety that she showed her teenage daughter where that folder was kept and hidden in the back of one of her drawers so that if anything ever happened to her, the police would be able to respond as quickly as possible. And advocates don't have to sit there and fill out all of this paperwork with the victim. You can give the victim the paperwork, and it's something, again, that empowers them and gives them something to do that can make them feel like they are taking positive steps to keep themselves safer. When we also talk about support, we do cocooning, something we recommend. If your victim is concerned about going to or from work, to or from school, having somebody else go with them, having somebody else look at their emails if they're getting threatening emails, listen to their phone messages, somebody who can be a bit of a buffer to them to help them deal with that kind of threat and harassment. We also are delighted that a support guide, How to Start and Facilitate a Support Group for Stalking Victims, is a publication that we recently completed here at the Stalking Resource Center. You have a picture of the cover here on your slide, and it is free and downloadable on our website. Lots of years in the making, got lots of great information and best practices from advocates all over the country with great suggestions, especially if you're in a rural area, if you're lacking resources, to how to help your stalking survivors get involved with having support. So threat assessment, again, as we talked about with our safety planning, it's fluid. And law enforcement does threat assessment all the time. They do it every time they go on a call, and all of us do it in other ways in our own life with things as simple as when you're rolling up to a yellow light. You know, when you're assessing, is it safe for me to go through the intersection? Should I stop? It's looking at all of the things that pose a risk to our victim. It's never going to be fixed. It's going to change over time, and we need to look at it and reassess it often with our victim to figure out the best ways to keep them threatened, to safe, rather, and to assess what their threat is at that moment. In doing it, we like to do a victim-centered approach, and despite the minimization issues that we're all aware of, we have found that victims' perceptions of risk can really be on the money a lot of the time. So their perception is really very important. Talk to the victim about their perception, again, remembering the possibility of minimization. But also, some detectives have said that they use, say, ask a victim, what is your fear like on a scale of 1 to 10? But also be aware, and we've heard situations where a victim has experienced increasing levels of behavior from a letter to a phone call to all of a sudden a pet being dead on the front porch. And an investigator will ask the victim, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how fearful are you? And the victim will say, I'm a 3. And it's like, but your pet is dead on your porch. So realizing that for your victim, in terms of what their fear level is, that they may respond differently than you would think they might to certain events. But talking to them about the scale of their fear, talking to them about the history of violence in the relationship, learning from them what the triggers are that they know of for their offender's abuse. Also, are there particular time patterns that they know about? Are there certain times of year that it's worse? Are there certain events that are happening that make it worse? And also, how frequent are in the past were the triggers that created the violence? And we've had several people mention this during the call, looking at the more dangerous times for our victims. Because, yes, while stalking does occur while people are still in relationship, separation is a more dangerous time for a victim, when a protective order is served or when there's an arrest. And so it's also important to work with law enforcement and with the courts to make sure there are consequences. You know, there are conditions of bond if someone is released that take into consideration victim safety, or that you try and keep someone in custody, or if there is a protection order in place, is there going to be service of that order? And if there are violations, are there going to be consequences? Because all of those things will play into figuring out how much risk your victim is in. And other events in your offender's life can heighten the threat level. Loss of a job, other life events, death of a parent or a family member, things that increase stress in our offenders' lives are going to make them less stable and make them potentially lash out more at our victims. Looking at more incidents in a short period of time, and looking not only at the quantity of the contact, but as well as the quality in terms of, are the behaviors increasing? There are more dangerous offenders and more risk potentially when there is substance abuse, when there's mental illness, especially if there is a narcissistic personality at play in terms of, this is all your fault, you hurt me, you're going to pay for it, none of this was me. The offender who is always saying, well, she's the one who caused all of this, I didn't have any blame in this. Those can be very, very challenging and really increase the risk to our victims. Histories of violence, especially toward the victim, and threats of murder or murder-suicide. We all can probably think of situations where we've seen locally and across the country where, when our offenders get to the point that they're ready to end their own lives, they're willing to take the lives of our victims and also children right before they do it. So if you've got those kinds of threats or verbalizations, that is a huge red flag about increased risk. Again, looking at who are our more dangerous offenders, if you have actual pursuit versus people who are doing things from a distance like letters or phone calls or things that aren't face-to-face, possession or fascination with weapons, vandalism and arson. Talking to law enforcement, these are regularly indicators of an escalation of violence in our stalking behavior. Tendency towards emotional outbursts and rage, and a history of violating protective orders. If they are going to ignore what a judge has told them, it is a clear indication to us that they are more dangerous and that they are not going to respond to people within the system telling them to stop the behavior. If you look at this next slide, it's so helpful with stalking because it's a course of conduct to do timelines. And if you look at the first slide, we have between June 6th and June 25th, six different events. So we've got a fair number of events in a relatively short period of time. And if you look at the next slide, not only are we looking at the time frame, but let's look at the kinds of events we have. We go from letters, which is the least personal, to threatening phone calls, to showing up at work. So we're there with the offender in our victim's face. We've got dead roses, another strong symbol. We've got parking across the street all night, and then we've got the cat being poisoned. This not only shows us a lot of events within a short period of time, but it shows that our events are getting more serious. And these are all indicators of working with our victim because we feel and believe, given these events, that he or she is at an increased risk. And I've given you this slide with some of the different psychological and risk factors and a study that will give you more information about looking at risk assessment in stalkers. So, when we're safety planning, what do we need to do? We need to gather information, analyze the problem and the risk factors, work with our victims to identify specific goals that our victims want to pursue, look at all the strategies and resources that are available to us, and then help individuals and then identify individuals and service providers who can help. The next slide shows you a potential blank safety plan, and we have these forms, that look at identifying a specific problem, look at the things that increase the risk, look at who else is effective, then move into specifically identifying what will help, who can help, how, and what those people need to do or what the victim needs to do so those people can help. And if you look at the next slide, we have a hypothetical example of how to really use the form in a nuts and bolts way. Our problem is that the abuser shows up at work, he knows where the victim lives, the home is not secure, and the abuser knows the victim's family. So when looking at things that would increase, what increases the risks? The victim is working a later shift, which makes it feel less safe to her to be coming out late at night. In terms of the home being not secure, there's bad locks and poor lighting. Who else is affected? Well, if the victim is at work, even if there are fewer employers and it's less safe, there are potentially still other people there, so the other employees and the employers are also affected. With the abuser knowing where the victim lived, the roommates and neighbors are affected. The home not being secure affects the roommate, and the abuser knowing the family puts the family at risk as well. So what does the victim identify as things that will help, and what can you help them identify? Asking the employer to increase safety, changing locks, asking neighbors to keep an eye out, and getting the police to the scene quickly. Those are all things that would help. And then identifying who then helps with that. Working with the abuser, working with the employer to keep the abuser away, working with the police to arrest, talking with neighbors and informing them and getting them aware of the situation, asking them to let the victim know when the offender shows up, the same with the roommate, coming to a DV program or a stalking program and getting counseling and advocacy and support, and also the faith community. Depending on how much that is a part of your victim's life, can really respond and be a good piece to assist them. And then identifying the specific NINGs, protection orders, photos, and other applications perhaps for funds to the faith community that would specifically tell the victim these are concrete steps you can take to help make yourself safer. And again, we are balancing freedom and safety. We're talking about next steps in case something happens. We're working with our victim to say, do we need to look at this plan once a week, once a month? Do you want to call me when you get a sense that things are changing? How are we going to keep this safety plan current? And again, always making sure that our victims don't have a false sense of security. So, questions or comments at this point?
If you have a question at this time, press 1 on your telephone, and your line will be opened.
Okay. Safe, your line is now open.
Yes, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that there was a stalking log for documentation on the site, and can you tell me where to find that?
Sure. Let's see. It should be on resources for victims. If you let me, I will open my browser and I will.
What site am I on?
The Stalking Resource Center site. I apologize. If you go to www.ncvc.org/src. And I think it's actually on our last slide. Yes, it is.
I don't have access to that, so.
Okay. If you don't mind, caller, if you hang on at the end of this call, I'll be sure to put you in touch in a better way with that piece of information. Is that all right?
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any other questions or comments at this time?
Yes. Next, we do have KNS. Your line is open.
I'm not sure if I'm the one that you're asking for. This is the Kansas Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence.
Yep, go
and
ahead.
I had a question about if you are running across employers who really, there's a negative consequence to telling them that you are being stalked. We've been hearing more than a few instances where the employer really just gets rid of the employee who's being stalked because the rest of the employees are at risk.
You raise a really good point and a really good question, and the sad answer is yes, we're hearing the same thing that you are. And while we can understand that employers are trying to balance safety, we are very frustrated that we're hearing the exact same thing, that a number of employers are too concerned that the stalker is going to come into the workplace, so they're firing victims, which is just dreadful. And there has been talk, and some states are looking at doing legislation so that employers cannot fire victims because of disclosing that information. That's the same kind of legislation at times that landlords have to respond to victims and can't evict victims for the same reason. And also, if a victim needs to relocate, that they need to have no financial penalties for leaving their lease early, but it's a huge problem. Occasionally, I love getting calls and hearing from employers who I got a call from an attorney, an in-house counsel for one organization where they had someone who was being stalked. They were a national organization, and they were so supportive and were going to and were willing to move this woman and pay for her to move to a new city to get away from her stalker. Unfortunately, I get fewer of those calls and those stories than I do of the employers that are firing their victims. So it's a real problem. Do you have any ideas or suggestions, anybody, in terms of ways that we could try to deal with that?
Well, I think one of the first things we have to do is talk with the stalking victim and say, is this a safe resource for you to use your employer that way? So sometimes I think we assume going to our employer is going to be safe, but I think that's the first question you have to ask is whether this would be, is this a good thing to do?
I think that's a really good idea, and that's a really good thing to be discussing with the victim.
Okay, next we do have Abused Persons Outreach Center. Your line is open.
Hi, I am the campus advocate here at the local university, and I just wanted to make sure that if there is someone sending, for example, a bouquet of black roses or dead roses, is it a good idea to take pictures of anything like that, so that can all be documented?
I think absolutely. And we see more stalking on college and university campuses than we do in the general population. And things like Facebook and MySpace and just the general way that people live on a campus and how you know where somebody is all the time and you have enough time in a semester to develop an infatuation or ask somebody out, get rejected and get angry about it, that it's a real concern. And I'm glad to have campus advocates involved. You're such a valuable piece. But absolutely, I would take pictures and document all of those things that come in.
Okay, so there would be anything that you can take pictures of to document it would be a good idea.
I think so, yeah.
Okay. But
can you think of a downside? Is there a reason you wouldn't want to?
No, not at all. And I'm glad that you brought up Facebook because, I've already experienced some implications with that as far as I'm also the victim witness advocate for the state attorney's office, and we've already had cases brought up with that. So, that's something that I think we need to be careful with.
Absolutely. If you're working with a victim who has any kind of social networking profile, the first thing you should be talking with them about is their privacy settings on those pages and making sure that they're aware and have gone through those privacy settings, that they are limiting, realizing that there can be impersonation, and that I learned because I have a Facebook page that every time you post a photo album or any kind of photos on Facebook, their default setting is for those photos to be public. And you have to affirmatively check a box to say that you only want your friends to see it. And they'll also give you an option that friends of your friends can see it. So we need to raise our victims' awareness that cyber world can be a place where people can get lots of information about them, and they have to be much more cautious and careful about what they're putting out there about themselves.
Exactly. I think sometimes people have a sense of being safe because they're in their own home when they're on their computer and doing these kinds of things, but they need to be really careful.
Exactly. Thank you.
So, Jody, this is Liz. We have just a little over 10 minutes left and a number of valuable slides yet about the CCR response to stocking. And so I wonder, is there a way that we can kind of compress the remaining slides to emphasize, everyone will have them, of course, in the PowerPoint, but to kind of emphasize for you the most critical points?
Certainly. Thank you, Liz. And I know that Praxis does great work around coordinated community response and that there's a good likelihood that a lot of you have already got really good CCR practices in your community. And one of the big things that we really like to have discussion about is how does stocking fit into that? And a CCR can be so critical for stocking because the intervention lasts so long with stocking, and none of us are overstaffed and overfunded and have more resources than we know what to do with. So by coming together, it is easier for us as a community to respond to this often long-term course of conduct. Also, it sends a really strong message to the community. If you have a CCR around stocking, it sends the message to your community that you all take stalking very seriously, and it can change and alter your community's views about not minimizing or downplaying the reality of stalking. One of the things that we hear from around the country and that goes differently in different places is if you choose, and we would encourage you to go forward with a coordinated community response, if you already have a coordinated community response to domestic violence or sexual assault, do you just add stalking to that? And some people, because of resources, because we all probably feel that we already have enough meeting in our lives, and some people are hesitant to add yet another group or another meeting to it, some people think that it's a good thing to add the stalking piece to an already existing CCR for a related topic. Other people get concerned that that, again, just minimizes stalking and makes it a sort of and also and doesn't give it the real focus that it needs to get it addressed in the community. So that's something I would love to hear people's thoughts on when we get to that question place. And no matter what you do, whether you do it as part of one that's existing or on its own, I would encourage you to think about what comes into play in stalking that doesn't always come into play with domestic violence or sexual assault if you're adding it on. Thinking about your specific community, what you have there, who are your partners, who are other people that maybe weren't involved before that you'd like to involve now, thinking about your obstacles and finding ways as a community to overcome them. I hope that some of you had the opportunity to look at the links in the chain video. You can, and you've got the information on how to find it on YouTube and watch it for free. And it's got two very different views. It's got the New York State Anti-Stalking Task Force, which had no budget, and which I think is a really interesting and positive model for our economically tight times for ways to respond to stalking. And then you have the family justice model from San Jose, which is, you know, family justice centers do really good things. And thinking about if either of those would work well for you. And we have a lot of documents. You have some on the slides, and you can get them from us that will provide you with samples of memorandums of understanding. But it's such a beneficial way for all of you to have this foundation so that when a stalking victim comes in, you aren't getting to know each other's policies and protocols for the first time. You've already come together as a group. You have already decided how you as a community are responding to stalking. And clearly, your victims are going to benefit from that collaboration by all of the people in the community. So with that, I would love to open it up to hear people's thoughts on problems that you think exist that keep you from developing a CCR for stalking, great things that you have done in your community that might benefit others to hear in terms of best practices and what's working for you.
So if there's any questions at this time, particularly about the slides that we had to really pass over quite quickly related to CCRs. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Press 1 on your keypad one time, and your phone line will be open for questions and comments. Stephanie, do we have any callers at this time?
At this time, we have no callers in the queue.
Okay. So if I can just jump in here for a moment.
Excuse me, Liz?
Yes.
We do actually have several at this time.
Okay, good.
Okay.
Good. Let's go into it.
Sounds good. First, we have Pave. Your line is open.
Hi. What kind of work do you recommend doing with law enforcement and whatnot as far as getting them to recognize stalking? I have issues, I know, in my community of even getting them recognizing that as a crime. When I do have victims that want to seek other legal remedies.
Well, that can be a challenge, though we do work with a lot of wonderful law enforcement. If your
mm-hmm.
community is having issues, education is always the good first step. Is
mm-hmm.
someone, one person on the department that you or someone you know has a relationship with, trying to get them to just at least have a conversation. We will often come into a community. You can fill out a training request form. If you can get someone who was involved with your law enforcement's training to be willing to have their officers come to a training or to do a webinar. Another thing that is in our work plan for 2010 is we are creating like a 10-minute roll call video on stalking that we are going to be rolling out probably toward the end of the year and hopefully working with our law enforcement partners to try and get all cops at roll call or whatever their equivalent is in their community to at least have a raised awareness. And one of the things that we do, and we can talk with you depending on where you are in the country, we always try when we're working with law enforcement, we have a group of current and retired law enforcement officers who have worked stalking cases, and we all know that law enforcement takes in information differently when they hear it from another cop. Advocates take it in differently from other advocates and prosecutors the same way. So if you can get just one cop to assist with letting them know how important this is, that's a really good first step.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Valencia Shelter Services. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. First of all, this is Carla Barella. I'm the outreach coordinator, and I'm in a room with my promotoras, who are a grassroots community effort funded by the DOJ to help our underserved populations. We do have a CCRT in place in Valencia County. The problem is the language barrier. On your website for resources, I noticed that you've got brochures for victims, a stalking sheet, the sample MOUs. Is there anything? Are these in Spanish or English only?
They're in Spanish, too. The fact sheet is in Spanish. The Are You Being Stalked is in Spanish.
Great. Thank you.
I'll oh, well.
Busy today. That's what I needed.
Are there any other questions or comments, Stephanie? Okay. So, Stephanie, I'm going to assume that there are no more questions or comments at this time.
Not at this time.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Well, actually, we do have Jacaria Behavioral Health Department.
Okay, let's take – this will be our last one, I think.
Okay. Your
go
line
ahead,
is
please.
Open.
Ma'am?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question, and it's pronounced Jicaria.
Thank you for that correction. Thank you. Go ahead, Jicaria.
All right. We work for the domestic violence program on our reservation, and currently we do not have stalking laws. But my question, just listening to everything, was what happens when an officer does the stalking and he has access to the technology?
Detention, correction,
law enforcement, law, court system, you know, what can be done? Or, I mean, you know, because I know we don't have a law. We do not have stalking laws.
You're probably bringing up the most challenging situation that we have, and I wish I had an answer for that. I would love to have an answer for that. It's a huge, huge problem, because if the offender is in the system and if he's using technology, you know, we hear horror stories all the time of his coworkers and buddies don't take the victim seriously. They let the offender know that she's reporting. So I don't know whether there's a way to get another department involved, whether the victim relocates. It is the most challenging situation we have. In terms of your tribe not having laws, I recently spoke at the Tohono O'odham Nation down by in Arizona, and they were working with their tribal elders to get stalking codes into their tribal codes. So that may be a good first step for you, is working with the community and seeing if there's a way to get stalking included in your code. And we actually have our Deputy Director of Public Policy, who always works with people who are interested in drafting new laws, so we could put you in touch with her. But you have asked the hardest question that's out there.
To the program in Jicarilla?
Yeah.
Are you in touch with Mending the Sacred Hoop at all?
Mending the Sacred Hoop? Yeah, we have knowledge of it.
Okay. I think they are going to be the most helpful resource to you.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of code development and stalking response within a reservation. And so I would recommend that you get in touch with them. There's a very good national trainer named Diane Wettendorf, and her area of specialty is law enforcement, you know, abusers who are also law enforcement agencies. And that's her area of specialty, but I think because you are going to have jurisdictional issues, certainly, on your reservation, Mending the Sacred Hoop is going to be the best bet for you.
Okay, yes. I have one more comment.
Sure.
Hold on.
Okay, this comes out of the department again, the Jicarilla Nation. Assigning victims and perpetrators to services in the smaller or rural communities actually perpetrates or paves the way for higher incidents of stalking, because they have more opportunities, and we've seen this.
No, you make a very good point, and it really is a challenge in the small communities and in the tribal communities to try and find ways to keep the victim and the offender separate. And another resource, I think, Liz, I thank you, Liz, so much for mentioning Mending the Sacred Hoop. And also the Southwest Center for Law and Policy and Hallie Bonger-White is another really good resource in terms of issues in the Native American system and enforcement.
Unfortunately, I think we are at the end of our session. So I'd like to thank all of you so very much for taking the time out of your day to join us. We've had tremendous response, and I am just so very grateful to Jody for all the information that she crammed into this PowerPoint. When I looked at it, I just thought there is no way we're going to be able to get through all of this information, and lo and behold, she did it. I don't think I've ever heard anybody talk as fast as Jody has been talking for the last 90 minutes, and I think that you've done a fantastic job, Jody, in compiling all this information into one place so that even if we didn't delve into any of it with detail, it will be resources that people will be able to pursue after the fact.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you for the great work Praxis does. And thank you for all of you, like Liz said, out on your phone lines who have made the time for the call. And we really appreciate all the work you're doing. And if we at the Stalking Resources Center can be of any assistance, please don't hesitate to reach out to use the resources on our website and follow up with me or anyone else at the SRC if we can assist you with stalking in your community.
So we are very grateful to the Office on Violence Against Women for sponsoring these calls. And, of course, Stalking Awareness Month is a very, very important time to call attention to a very important issue. So thank you again, all of you. Be well. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you, Liz. Bye-bye, everybody.